Hello, I'm your host, Jake Raymer, and this is Uncirculated History, where we discuss lesser-known historical facts and stories through American coinage. This episode covers the 1943 steel penny. Although it's a collector's item today, the steel penny was born of a wartime shortage of copper, as copper was needed for shell casings and munitions during World War II. So, how did a penny come to represent an era of xenophobia, racism, and sexism in America? Well, it all started with America entering World War II.
Yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy. The United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan.
The attack at Pearl Harbor was universally described as a sneak attack. We now know that the Japanese did plan to warn the United States that they were breaking relations, but that it didn't get communicated in time because of a technical screw up.
This is Peter Kuznick, a history professor at American University who is an expert on 20th century America.
Nearly 3,000 people were killed. Much of the American fleet was destroyed on December 7th, 1941. And so that's a big factor in American racist attitudes toward the Japanese. But on top of that, we've got the reports that came out about the treatment of American troops at Bataan.
From January to April 1942, American and Filipino forces fought the Japanese on the Bataan Peninsula of the Philippines near Manila Bay. A combined 76,000 soldiers from the American and Filipino forces surrendered. This was the largest American surrender since the Civil War. Shortly after, the American and Filipino prisoners of war were forced into the Bataan Death March.
We've got the reports that came out about the treatment of American troops at Bataan, not just Americans, also Filipinos, but the stories there about the castration, tying the prisoners to the trees and using them for bayonet practice, burying people alive, the vivisection, the crucifixion, horrible things that were done. That was taking place mostly in 42.
Professor Kuznick went on to say that even though the reports regarding the mistreatment of POWs did not come out until 1944, the feelings Americans had towards the Japanese intensified considerably around this time. On February 19th, 1942, Executive Order 9066 was signed by President Franklin Delano Roosevelt. This allowed the Secretary of War to relocate and incarcerate around 120,000 Japanese Americans living on the West Coast. About 80,000 of those Japanese Americans were second-generation American-born U.S. citizens, and some were even third-generation.
In terms of the internment camps, that begins very, very early in 1942. And there was no good reason for doing that. Even J. Edgar Hoover, who is not known as a great civil libertarian, did not believe it was necessary to put Japanese in internment camps. He said all the Japanese who represent any kind of security threat have already been taken care of, they've been identified. But putting 110 to 120,000 Japanese in 10 camps was a colossal violation of civil rights and human rights. Now, there was the assumption that the Japanese were gonna be a fifth column inside the United States, that the Japanese would serve as spies, that they would assist the Japanese effort. And there was even concern that the Japanese would bomb, especially on the West Coast. But there was no sabotage. There was no illegality. There was no disloyalty. And their neighbors took the land, took the stores, took the property, and that cost of billions of dollars to the Japanese community. So this was a very, very backward policy that reflected that deep-seated racism, but also the specific hatred toward Japan for what the Japanese had done at Pearl Harbor and Bataan and throughout the war.
Despite this, an estimated 33,000 Japanese Americans served in the U.S. military. One of the most notable fighting units was known as the 442nd Infantry Regiment. which was composed almost entirely of second-generation Japanese-American soldiers.
Many Japanese-Americans did serve in the war. They served heroically. Many were wounded. Some were killed. They were very, very highly decorated, and they served the United States loyally despite this discrimination that their families were undergoing.
As war efforts abroad continued to intensify, the United States government made accommodations to supply troops with the right equipment.
Production for war is based on metals and raw materials: steel, copper, rubber, aluminum, zinc, tin.
On January 8, 1942, Public Law 815 was passed by the 77th Congress. This authorized metal substitutes to be used for the production of nickels and pennies. Treasury Secretary Henry Morgenthau Jr. didn't waste any time. Starting January 1, 1943, all 1-cent coins were struck in low-grade steel with an ultra-thin zinc coating to prevent rust. This drastic change for the penny, in a way, represents the increasing war efforts and rising tensions in America.
Production for war is based on men and women, the human hands and brains, which collectively we call labor.
The Rosie the Riveter campaign was a very important part of the war effort. And it's interesting that, so now the men are overseas, the women are independent, they have their own incomes, and the divorce rate skyrockets after the war. What we see is women filling a lot of those factory jobs that were necessary to win the war, and African Americans doing so also. So we see on the part of African Americans a continued expansion of the migration from the South to the northern cities and going to work in the factories. There was still a lot of discrimination. Not only in the military were African Americans segregated, but also in the workplaces.
In early 1941, civil rights activist A. Philip Randolph, who organized the first African American labor union, announced a march on Washington to protest discrimination in the defense industry.
In response to that, President Roosevelt passes an executive order, number 8802, which bans discrimination in the employment of workers in the defense sector on the basis of race, creed, or national origin or color.
We must raise our sights all along the production line. Let no man say it cannot be done. It must be done, and we have undertaken to do it.
During the war, there were at least a half dozen race riots in the United States. There were lots of racial confrontations in overseas. But we had big race riots in Mobile, Alabama in 1943, in Detroit in 1943, in Harlem in 1943. Many, many people were killed in those race riots.
For African American soldiers fighting abroad, discrimination was also prevalent. Even though African American forces represented less than 10% of all U.S. troops in the war, they represented more than 40% of the soldiers tried for sex crimes in Europe. In 2/3 of those cases, they were convicted.
So this kind of discrimination against black soldiers is, again, very, very destructive, wrongheaded, unfair, and debilitating. But there was a lot of racial tension during the war. Now, the black strategy was what they called the double V campaign. So they wanted to end racial discrimination at home. At the same time, we were defeating racism overseas.
Throughout the duration of the war, African American troops were still segregated and were restricted from having higher positions than their white counterparts. The treatment of marginalized groups in America during World War II shouldn't be forgotten, because without these communities, the war could have ended with a much different outcome. The steel penny today serves as a reminder of those times and should be regarded as much more than the product of a wartime conservation effort. This podcast was produced and edited by me, Jake Raymer. I would like to thank my guest, Professor Peter Kuznick, and Professor Jill Olmsted for her guidance. Thank you for listening to Uncirculated History.